me up. I don't know how to argue with what's essentially true. Amelia and the others here on Gaia are destroying the only chance we have at unlocking the secrets of the undying. It's unfathomable to me, this willingness to disregard everything we could learn, and to take such unthinkable risks with humanity's safety, just for the sake of quick cash. But I can't say any of that out loud, not and keep her here with me, so I fall silent. We'd always thought we were alone in the universe, or that any other life was so unimaginably far away that we might as well be. The quickening decline of our planet, the worldwide realization that we were doomed, was what sparked the formation of the International Alliance. Created to realize the idea of building a ship capable of traveling to the next solar system, and the planet astronomers had dubbed Centaurus so that humanity might endure, the IA represented the power of ideas, faith in the future, the infinite vision and reach of our species. It represented hope. It was such a thing to have done, the whole of humanity pulling together, pooling resources, launching our colonists, an inspired act of cooperation, unimaginable before the rapidly changing climate put all our other petty grievances on hold. But then, 8 years into their journey, just over 50 years ago now, something went catastrophically wrong. Their final transmission was a plea for help, playing over and over, for the International Alliance to save them. But the IA couldn't, or perhaps wouldn't, commit the colossal resources required for a second mission, a rescue mission able to reach them beyond the edge of our solar system. That had always been the understanding, that the Centauri colonists would be on their own once they left the heliosphere for interstellar space. "We're sorry," was Earth's response. "Godspeed." There was a camp that thought we should have salvaged the Centauri mission at any cost. That we weren't just saving lives, we were saving our last hope, a journey we had to take. But others argued we simply didn't have the money, the resources, that we couldn't afford to attempt rescuing 300 souls, most likely lost already by the time their distress call reached Earth, at the cost of projects that could aid hundreds of thousands, even millions of people suffering now on Earth. Eventually, their looped distress call simply faded away. All those lives, those resources, the unprecedented global cooperation, for nothing. The mission's failure convinced mankind the stars didn't hold any solutions for us, not that our technology could reach. What we had was all we'd ever have. We couldn't simply flee the world we were destroying to find another. The International Alliance rebranded itself, turning away from the stars in order to find ways to extend the remaining resources on Earth. Until, that is, the small handful of astronomers, still searching for confirmation of the Centauri mission's demise, picked up a new signal. Until my father, the famed mathematician and linguist Elliot Addison, decoded the undying broadcast. Until that broadcast led us to Gaia, a planet with secrets and technology so powerful an entire species destroyed itself fighting over them. I'm not so naive as to think that the companies hiring people like me are trying to solve the mystery of the undying for the good of humanity. They want the alien tech for themselves, a monopoly. After seeing what the solar cell could do in Los Angeles, most of the world thinks this tech will solve all of Earth's energy problems. The company that manages to unlock Gaia's secrets will make a killing. But their vision is locked so firmly on this one earthly goal that they forget to lift their gazes. They forget to see the stars, as humanity once did, as we all used to do when we were children. When we learned about other stories and cultures for the sake of doing so, for how those revelations changed us, what they made us. Gaia is the chance to learn on a scale we've never imagined before, and instead we've become traitors and thieves. I accepted Global Energy's offer to lead their expedition because they could get me here. Their sleek executive, Charlotte, found me through my cousin and best friend, Neil. He's an engineering major, and he's interning with them this year. He and Charlotte got to talking, and she came to understand what others didn't, that I'm my father's son in many ways, and knowledgeable enough about Gaia to help achieve both our ends. So she made me an offer I couldn't refuse. They could put me on Gaia's surface, and as long as I shared my findings with them, I could choose my own course. Nobody's pretending they're not in this race for their own corporate interests, but Charlotte understands there are bigger questions to be answered here, and she cares about more than profit. I still didn't tell her which temple I was heading for, of course. Mia may think I'm an idiot, but I'm not stupid enough to give away the existence and location of what my father believes will be the defining discovery on Gaia, the one that proves once and for all whether we're saving or dooming ourselves. I intended to hit a couple of smaller temples first as misdirection, to keep them from realizing I'm not here to uncover tech. The one upside to having missed my exploration party is that I don't have to hide my goal and its significance, and I can head straight for the spiral-shaped temple. There I can look for an explanation that will prove my father right, once and for all, or, though I can't imagine it, prove him wrong. Somehow, the fact that there was a third option never really sank in. That I might not prove the danger of the tech or uncover it, because I could die without ever making it to the temple or penetrating its defenses. Mouth dry, palms damp, with a girl symbolizing everything my father stands against, everything I stand against, I'm suddenly wondering how much my life is worth. When I look up, Mia's frowning, scanning the ridge with her goggles in place. From the way she adjusts a dial on the side, I'm assuming she's got some kind of magnification lens in there. What is it?
Maybe nothing,
she replies, though there's a tension in her voice that makes me question her nonchalance.
Thought I saw a flash up there on the rim, but it's hard to tell with light coming from two different suns. It's weird here. Eyes play tricks on you.
Think someone's following us. My thoughts summon up the trouserless man's face as he glared daggers at me. I have no doubt he's both rearmed and retrousered by now. But would they really deviate from the path they believe holds all the riches and glory, just to take revenge on a couple of teenagers?
I don't think they'd bother coming after us for just one bike,
Mia replies, echoing my own thoughts.
But we'd better keep moving just in case. The farther away from the other path we get, the less likely they are to keep following us, if they're following us at all.
We remount the skimmer in silence after that. My stomach is in knots, and I know it's not just the twists and turns of the skimmer bike. I don't like misleading her. I've never really experienced. Is this camaraderie? I'm not sure I'd know. I've just never been very good at knowing what to do with people my own age. Even when we were all very small, the other children knew I wasn't quite the same as them, and try as I might, I could never fit into their games. I asked too many questions, I think. My cousin Neil was the nearest I came, with his quick grin and quicker wit. Popular with the ladies, even more popular with the gentlemen, Neil. He more or less harassed me into joining him on the university water polo team against my protestations, and to everyone's surprise, I loved it. To our collective astonishment, I was good at it. He dragged me onto the back of his bike as well, giving me the practice I'd need here on Gaia, though neither of us ever could have imagined that. He dragged me out to sea and do new things over and over, trying with all his might to breathe some youth into me. When the few friends I'd managed to accumulate left after my father's disgrace, Neil was the one who stayed. He was the one who kept me on the team. I heard him arguing with the captain when I arrived for practice the night after my father's arrest, wondering if I'd still be welcome.
He's just a kid!
I can still hear the anger in my cousin's voice, a note I'd never heard before.
He's not just anything,
the captain replied. I nearly turned around and walked out again, but some stubbornness made me continue on to the change rooms.
Something in me decided that if I wasn't welcome there, then they'd have to tell me to my face. And maybe I was just very good at polo, because nobody ever did. And so I stayed, though the early green shoots of friendship with my teammates died away. Nothing survives for long in the desert of our disgrace. Amelia's the one to restart the conversation a couple of hours later, when we take another break to stretch. She pulls down her kerchief so she can snag a few lungfuls from her breather, silent long enough that I'm surprised when she breaks the quiet to speak.
How do you know you're taking us to the right temple? How much do you know about the Undying?
The basics of what we know about the ancient aliens are taught even in regular schools, I assume. Except I'm not sure how much school Amelia actually attended, so I'm treading carefully. She shifts, leaning back against a rock and eyeing me.
I know enough.
Not helpful. I hunt for my least lectury tone. The broadcast that reached us 50 years ago, the one Dr. Addison decoded when he was at university, didn't just give the instructions on how to build the portal to Gaia. It also talked about how they destroyed themselves. She interrupts.
That the precious technology they've hidden here on Gaia is their legacy, that only worthy people can inherit it, blah, blah, blah. I'm not a total idiot, Jules. I didn't come here knowing nothing.
Ah, but see, what most people don't know is that there's a code within the code. My father was the one who discovered the second layer of encoding in the Undying's message. It's classified. Originally, they all thought it was just a distortion in the message, but actually, it was intentional. And this is where I lie to her. Not about the existence of the second layer of the code. That part is true. Just about what it says.
Beneath the instructions for the portal were a set of coordinates showing which of their structures held the key to finding their precious technology.
There's a what now?
Amelia's frowning at me.
If there were more information, telling us where to look, we'd know it. The IA's good at keeping secrets, but not that good.
I wipe my brow, glad I thought to pull out a handkerchief from the discard pile when Amelia was throwing away half my gear.
They kept this one. And anyway, only a handful of academics know how to translate it.
The frown's graduated to a scowl, though it makes lying to her no easier. The scowl's almost as appealing as her smile. But some of Amelia's skepticism is fading away in favor of curiosity, and she leans forward.
You're still talking about Elliot Addison, aren't you? This is the warning he was trying to give on TV before they cut the feed. This is what he went to jail for. You're saying you know what he knows?
I'm treading on dangerous ground here. I know even more than that, but I don't want her to realize she's talking about my father. She's a scaver, and I won't ever be able to entirely trust her. She certainly wouldn't trust me if she knew whose son I am.
I do, and before you ask, no, I'm not telling you how I know. That's not a part of this deal.
She closes her mouth, frowning again. But the expression shifts as she mulls my words over, and eventually she's eyeing me with cautious interest.
So you're telling me that you have, essentially, a secret map to all the good stuff that no one else has?
Not exactly how I'd put it, but yes. I'm lying.
I'm lying. But I have no choice.
She squints at me for a long moment, a dimple in her cheek suggesting that she's chewing at her lip.
I don't suppose you've also got a map outlining the locations of all the traps and pitfalls and puzzles inside. Like the ones at the big temple that pulverized half the astronauts in Explorer 4.
Not as such, no.
But you can read their writing? Understand their language?
As well as anyone can. I pause. Except for Elliot Addison, of course. She's watching me, eyes narrowed, and for a long, breathless moment, I'm certain she's figured it out. I have lighter skin than my father, due to my mother's genetic contribution, but we've got the same hair, the same eyes, the same jaw. I'm waiting for her to ask me how I could possibly know what I know. Someone as savvy as she is wouldn't just take the word of a near stranger on any of this. She's going to demand answers. Any second now. I've only told her a fraction of the whole story. It's true about the layers of coding. There's the first layer, telling us of the riches of the undying, waiting to be claimed by the worthy. And then there's the second. The layer we thought was a distortion in the signal, a blip of no consequence, ignored for decades. It's different from the first, shoved in there like an afterthought. It's inelegant, messy, inconsistent, in ways that are hard to quantify. There's a not-rightness about it that's hard to pin down. And the message it conveys is much, much smaller than the first. When you graph it, the mathematical equation in that second layer of code marks out a shape resembling a Fibonacci spiral, like a Nautilus shell or our own Milky Way, but subtly altered. And there's just one word, its isolation making it all the more difficult to translate. But we think we know what it means. Catastrophe. Apocalypse. The end of all things. It's this secret layer, with its scientific inconsistencies, that stopped my father in his tracks. He was already begging the IA to slow down, to try to understand what the words meant before looting Gaia like the world was clamoring for them to do. But that second layer of code changed everything for him. Here was proof, he claimed, of what he'd been saying all along. The Undying themselves were sending us a message of danger, and if the IA couldn't justify slowing down for the sake of discovery, surely they'd have to slow down for practical reasons, for the safety of their expeditions and Earth itself. But the leaders of the International Alliance weighed the good of the many. Already Los Angeles has a fresh water plant, powered by just one small piece of undying tech, against the unfounded warnings of an academic already out of favor, and of course they decided against him. So he defied them, tried to warn the world, and now he's locked away. I only worked out what I had to do a couple of weeks ago. I was staring at the topographical maps of Gaia again, studying the now familiar lines for the thousandth time, when suddenly I blinked out of my daze and pulled the map in closer, my breath catching in my throat. Because there it was, at the end of a canyon, backed against a wall of cliffs. A small, otherwise unremarkable temple in the shape of a spiral, shaped into the same Nautilus spiral as the second secret layer of code. Only a handful of us even know about the Nautilus, and it's barely a speck on most of the maps, which is why none of the other scavengers are likely to bother with it. That temple is where I'll learn what the message means, where I'll learn why they paired this shape with the warning they did. The end of all things. That's where I'll find the answers to my father's questions. And if I have to lie to her, so be it. She's all I have to replace the expedition that was supposed to back me up, and my chances without her are slim at best. So I'll make sure she has reason to want to get to the temple, even if it means lying to her about what we'll find there. I expect her to read all of this on my face, to somehow know, to call me out, to walk away, chasing her loot and leaving me to survive alone. But instead she just leans forward and shoves to her feet with a groan for sore muscles and reaches for her pack.
Then we'd better keep moving.
The bike chews up the ground between us and the temple, and though the canyon's twists and turns make my stomach lurch, it provides us at least a little bit of cover in case our new friends manage to repair their bikes and pick up our trail. For the last part of our journey, though, we have to work together to heave the skimmer up the steep canyon wall. According to my maps, the temple should be just beyond the stone rim. Once we reach the top, I see it. A huge stone structure juts out of the cliff face at the end of the valley, its walls curving ever so slightly around in the start of the Fibonacci spiral it forms from above. I've studied every satellite photo of this temple, imagined myself standing before the huge pillars supporting the entrance 1,000 times in the last few weeks. But nothing prepared me for the reality of a structure built by an alien species. This moment feels holy.
Hey, Oxford!
It's only when Amelia shoves the bike into me that I realize I've dropped my end, leaving her to haul it over the lip of the cliff by herself. I grab the seat, pulling it onto level ground, then turn my attention back to the temple's facade.
That it?
She pants, clearly needing a few minutes with her breather.
That's it.
I can't contain myself. I can see the entrance chamber in my mind's eye. If this temple is anything like the one Explorer 4's astronauts photographed, there'll be carvings in the anteroom, frenzied and abstract. The patterns and waves of glyphs will be etched into the stone surfaces with the kind of violent exuberance that makes me want to get to know their creators, and makes me a little afraid of them. Dropping my pack, I'm walking toward it before I've even decided to move.
Jules, stop!
Amelia grabs my arm, dragging me to a halt.
It's been there a zillion years. It'll probably still be there in the morning. Let's not get blown up or melted or sliced and diced tonight, okay? It'll be dark soon. We can hole up here tonight. The temple walls will hide the light from our camp from the canyon floor.
I grit my teeth, forcing down a noise of frustration. She's right. Deus, I know she's right. And this is exactly the sort of thing I need her around for. But it's right there. I've spent my whole life dreaming of this. My father spent most of his life dreaming of this. A pang shoots through my heart, making my eyes water. He should be here. With an entire expedition of experts at his back, and the world holding its breath to see what he would uncover. I'll have to feel it for him. I breathe deep, gazing at the temple and letting the euphoria in.
There's nowhere left on Earth, I say,
the excitement bubbling up again, overruling my frustration.
Not the highest mountain, not the remotest desert, or the deepest trenches of the ocean. Nowhere someone else hasn't been first. But this, Mia, this is ours. Everybody else who comes here, they'll be walking in our footsteps. We have the privilege of this first glimpse of another culture, another species, another world.
I can't help it. The excitement rising in me. She's still holding my arm to keep me from running forward, and I grab hers in return, reeling her in so I can throw my arms around her, lifting her clean off her feet to turn in a wild circle.
Us first!
She gives a startled squawk as we whirl, and she swats at one of my arms, and it's the feel of her, wiry and tense and strong, that reminds me who she is. What she is. Scavenger. I set her down, trying for nonchalance, but getting only so far as awkward. She's got a smile on her face, small and a bit baffled though it is.
Let's make sure our first steps inside the temple aren't our last,
she says breathlessly, dismissively, but I can see an answering glimmer of excitement in her eyes. Some part of her gets it, that this isn't just about scavenging, that it can't be, no matter how badly you want money. For just an instant, she's not one of them. She's just a girl, standing at my side, while we linger before the doorway to an ancient alien world. I have to clear my throat, then clear it again.
Right. You're right. I want so badly to know why they let us here. What secret they're hiding. What really happened to them.
Her mouth quirks.
So long as you're not dying to know.
I can't hide my smile, despite her horrendous pun. And maybe a tiny bit because of it.
Just think, Mia. We could find anything in there. And tomorrow, we'll be the first humans in the universe to set foot inside that temple.
Chapter 5. Amelia. The desert surface of Gaia gets bitter cold once the suns go down. My phone's thermometer cheerfully announced to me that it was only a few degrees above freezing by the time we found a good spot to camp in the lee of the temple walls. Fortunately for me, I have some experience with deserts in my scavenging territory, so I wasn't exactly caught with my pants down. To be fair, neither was Jules. Caught with his pants down, I mean. Though, watching him now as he pulls a sweater on over that not-so-spotless-anymore button shirt, I can't say I would have minded much. Mia, get your head in the game. I have to stay focused on why I'm here. Before I register the impulse, my hands slipping into my pocket to pull out my phone again. It's set to automatically download incoming messages whenever the station or the relay satellites overhead. But I'm not really expecting anything when I unlock its screen and check my inbox. A few notices pop up that there's been bidding activity on some of my Chicago salvage auctions. But it's hard to care much this far away. If I die here, the auction site'll just confiscate my earnings. So it's not until the alert I've set up with a little icon of a pair of heart-shaped sunglasses pops up that my heart does an instant flip-flop. Evie. I glance at Oxford, who's hunched over the wave stove, and I stroll some distance away. I put in one of my earbuds, then play my sister's video message. Mia! Her voice, loud and bright in my right ear, instantly makes my eyes sting. I haven't seen her in 5 months. Dunno if you'll get this, but if you do, you should already be on Gaia. On Gaia! I mean, WTF. You're listening to me talk to you in another galaxy. She recorded this after a shift waitressing at the club. I can tell. Though she's changed into sweatpants and a tank top and taken off her makeup, I can see traces of the lipstick they make her wear, and her arms shimmer with the holographic glitter lotion that's supposed to make her look hotter. Hotter. My 14-year-old baby sister. This is why I have to get her out. Right now, she just takes drink orders. But once she turns 18... her contract doesn't let her stay a waitress forever. I wish I could be there with you, she goes on. Well, actually, not really. Actually, it sounds horrible. Impossible. But you like doing impossible things. I can't wait for you to get back. I'll meet you in Amsterdam. We saw a movie once, which we siphoned off a neighbor's net connection, where these two lovers had a plan to meet in Amsterdam when they'd both taken care of the obstacles between them. Our stolen connection cut out before the end of the movie, but Amsterdam became our end goal. Our code for a future without hiding and stealing. Without our constant fights about her staying in school while I worked. Without the constant fear of being found out as illegal sisters. Of course, neither of us is ever going to be able to afford to go to Europe. Our Amsterdam has always been Los Angeles, where the undying solar cell means there's clean water. It also means it's not cheap to live there. But expensive places are often safer. And with what I could make in a place like this, after Evie managed to get herself tangled up with the club while trying to help pay our bills, I found that movie again and watched the ending. One of the lovers killed himself, and the other took a fast food job in New Jersey where he had to wear a clown suit and advertise on street corners. I never had the heart to tell Evie. Evie's gone quiet in the video, her expression torn. She never wants to say anything that's hard. Everything's bright and hopeful. And to speak of fears and worries and hardships is to summon them closer, invite them to hover over us. I can see her struggling not to pour out her fear for me. Finally, she plasters a wide, brittle smile on her face and says, "I miss you. Stay safe." And then softly, almost as though she hopes her mic won't pick it up, "I wish you weren't there alone." She stares at me across the millions of light years between us. Then she presses her fingers to her lips and blows me a kiss. And the screen goes black. "I wish you weren't there alone." I glance over at Oxford, who's still puttering around the wave stove, looking like a mad scientist from an old movie. He's shivering as he doctors our dinners, but I can't tell if that's from cold, the thin air, or from the fact that his body, despite its lanky size, is clearly too small to contain the sheer volume of excitement coursing through it from being this close to an undying temple. I thought I knew excited. I mean, that time I found a 24 Chevy air bike almost intact in the remains of a collapsed garage had to be one of the highlights of my whole life. But this, if I weren't here, Jules would be through that temple entrance already, stumbling around in the dark, and probably on his way to being impaled by some spike trap by now. I feel like I've got a dog on a leash smelling freedom. And, metaphorical or not, that leash is stretched to the snapping point. I can feel his tension, as real as the cold creeping in the collar of my polar fleece hoodie. There are about a million questions swirling around in my head, and I have a feeling the answers could be dangerous. But Jules is clearly set on keeping his secrets. If I push him too hard, he might decide he doesn't need me after all. Not now that I've gotten him to the temple. But some teenaged kid doesn't just wind up here conveniently possessing the knowledge the entire human race has been trying to pry out of Elliot Addison's head. I'm going to figure out how he knows what he knows and what it means for me. But right now, when he sees his goal within reach, isn't the time to ask hard questions. Better to wait until he can't avoid them by leaving me behind. And I'm not naive enough to believe he won't drop the scaver scum he's had to team up with as soon as he thinks it's safe to kick me to the curb. Arming myself with as much information as possible is the best way to make sure that if anyone's getting a jump on anyone, I'm going to get one on him. "What's on the menu, Oxford?" I ask instead, as his eyes wander yet again to the sandy, dusty, and otherwise featureless wall of the temple next to us. Academic excitement or not, dinner smells good. And I'm not letting some doe-eyed professor type burn it because he thinks maybe one of those sand grains is going to tell him how the undying used to live. His eyes snap back after a moment's hesitation. He's got a flashlight that pulls apart into a lantern, and on its dimmest setting, I can make out the glimmer of his eyes meeting mine. "Oh, lime glazed chicken and wild rice with porcini and kale." I blink back at him. I think I heard chicken. His lips twitch. And as those eyes flash, I wonder if he's trying to size me up like I am him. It'll be delicious, I promise. I have a few days of real food, vacuum sealed, before we've got to resort to more drastic measures for our nutrition. Canned beans isn't drastic measures, I point out, feeling defensive. It's good. After some cayenne and brown sugar and about half a dozen other things to make it palatable, he removes the dish from the wave stove box and carefully splits its contents evenly into a second bowl for me. Part of me wants to point out I'm like half his size and that he's going to need more food than I will. But the bigger part of me wants to eat the hell out of that chicken and lime rice thing. So I shut my mouth and take the bowl he holds out to me. I do speak up, though, when he starts to pack the wave stove up again. Hey, wait. Throw some rocks in there. He pauses, his thick brows drawing inward in that way they do when he thinks I'm a whack job. Throw some what now? That thing heats stuff other than food, right? That can from the beans earlier today about burned my fingerprints off. It heats inorganic matter too, yes. Well, heat up those rocks. Wrap them up in your blanket with you when you sleep, and you'll be toasty warm. Not as nice as having another person to curl up with, but almost as good. I flash him a bright smile, just to see what happens. Even if the light was brighter, I'm not sure I could tell with his dark skin whether he was blushing. But when he swallows hard and turns away to locate some suitable rocks among the rubble, I know what I'm seeing. Score! He may think scavengers are scum, and that the Tomb Raiders here on Gaia are the scummiest of the scum. But he plays for my team, and he thinks I'm cute. And I can work with that. Sometimes cute gets you into trouble when you're traveling alone. I'm not an idiot. But one look at Jules, and you know he's not that guy. I'm pretty sure he's one of those guys who would have apologized the first time he kissed a girl, just in case he did it wrong. If, somewhere deep down inside, he still thinks I'm cute even after learning that I'm basically his arch nemesis, maybe we can work together anyway. I snuggle down into my blanket, cradle my bowl close to my chest, and watch him through the curls of aromatic steam rising around my chin. I'm trying to judge what's under the khakis, the button-down, the argyle sweater. Not that way. Though a girl's hormones will do what they do, not my fault, to figure out if he's got any athletic ability at all to go with his self-proclaimed genius. He's got strength. More than I'd have thought from an academic type. He about cut off my air supply with how hard he held on while we were on the bike. And he kept up with me when we were running. But I can't tell if he's got the conditioning we're going to need once we get inside. Hell, to be honest, I don't know what kind of conditioning we'll need once we get inside. I was only going to skim through the temple antechambers like the rest of the scavers. None of us has the ability to navigate the Undying's network of traps and pitfalls that killed the explorer astronauts. I don't know if I'll eventually have to ditch him so I can move faster, once he's gotten me past the Undying security checks. I don't want to ditch him. And not just because his know-how will be handy in figuring out whatever traps the Undying have left to try to kill unworthy looters. I like this guy. He's cute, in a don't-kick-the-puppy way. Hell, he's cute in a come-back-to-my-place-and-meet-my-puppy way. But I'm on Gaia. I'm on an alien planet. I've risked my life, everything I own, everything I could ever own or be or do for this chance. A pair of big brown eyes and a sheepish smile that flashes white in the dark when he sees me watching him. That I can find somewhere else once I get home. Maybe not the same smile. Maybe not the same eyes. But something. I let my breath out in a sigh and take a bite of my dinner. Oh, holy crap. I must have made some kind of happy place noise. Because when I manage to lift my head, I find Jules staring at me, mouth half open. He shuts it with a pop. Definitely blushing. But just now, I don't care. This is freaking awesome, I blurt. Blankets falling away as I sit bolt upright and start devouring my dinner. All thoughts of allies and betrayals and the color of his eyes go flying straight out the airlock. Chicken. And whatever a porcini is. I'm in. It isn't until we're finished and the bowls are wiped clean and the hot rocks from the wave stove are tucked inside our sleeping mats. Mine, a single thick weave blanket I can roll up in. His, a true space-age marvel of engineering with zippers and quilted pockets of God knows what, and a self-inflating pillow at one end, that we can actually talk again. I have vague memories of him trying to start up conversation over dinner, but at that point, I was more interested in what my spoon had to say. Now, though, as I look into the cool blue light of the dim lantern and the desert chill creeps in around my face, all that's left of the chicken is a warmth in my stomach and fingertips that smell like lime. And I feel reality setting in once more. Cute or not, he basically thinks I'm a monster. He thinks of what I do back home as pillaging, stealing, criminal in every sense. Though it's not like anyone's coming back for all the crap that got left behind when the sandstorm started sweeping through Lincoln Square. But if he thinks my regular work is a problem, he sees what I'm here to do as even worse, by a magnitude of infinity. To him, I'm here to kill what he's clearly devoted his life to discovering and preserving. I'm a monster. Why Gaia? His words come out of the dark so abruptly that I startle, jerking my gaze from the lantern and searching for him on the other side of it. My eyes are so dazzled by the light that all I can see is the red-green afterimage, lantern-shaped, dancing this way and that. What? Why come to Gaia to do this? The Raider gangs, that I can... Well, I can't understand that. But I know why they're here. Money will make people do a lot of stupid things. But you... You can't be more than what? 15? You should be in school. You should be home. He's been thinking about exactly the same thing I was. There's so much I want to say. What home? And I haven't been in school since I was 13. I'm not like you. I don't get to think about what I should do. Only what I've got to do. You don't get to decide my choices are stupid when you don't know a thing about me. Instead, what bursts out, in a voice so sullen I might as well still be 13, is... I'm 16, Oxford. Regardless, he replies, unfazed. Even if you have some reason not to be with your parents right now, or in school, you could be looking for a job with a little less almost certain death in the fine print. You're young. You could... Oh, and you're what, 30? Mr. I'm starting college early next year? With the after images from the lantern fading, I can see that he's frowning now. 17, he admits finally. Look, Emilia, this is all coming out wrong. I'm not trying to... Just... What could someone like you possibly need with the kind of money you get from a dangerous expedition like this that a normal job wouldn't get you? Someone like me? I know what he means when he says, someone like you. He's seen the grimy blue and pink hair with 2-inch brown roots showing, the worn boots, the gear cobbled together from ancient finds in old warehouses. He's heard the bad grammar, the advice from someone who's already seen years as a criminal. You think I'm just some stupid punk slum scaver who thought, oh, hey, I'll up my game and hop a spaceship to the other side of the galaxy. But since I'm clearly poor as dirt and dumb to boot, and couldn't tell you what the hell a porcini is, I couldn't possibly know what to do with a couple hundred grand in smuggled undying artifacts. So I should just find the nearest fast food joint and... I think you're smart. Jules interrupts me, voice quiet. And clever, which isn't the same thing. I think you're hurting about something, and I don't think you like what you're here to do. But you're too proud to admit that. So you're putting words in my mouth. And I think you'll find I don't really care for that. The silence that swarms in around us when he stops speaking makes my throat hurt. My head feels fuzzy. A combination of the exhaustion of the day and richer food than I'm used to eating and the lack of proper air. And something about what he said makes me want to pull my blanket over my head and cry. Just a little, where no one can hear me. But he's there. And he'd hear. Jules clears his throat, warning me this time that he's about to speak. What I meant to say was that you seem to me like a clever, beautiful girl who could more than support herself in any of a dozen ways on Earth. Which either means I'm wrong about you, and I don't think I am. Although, come to think of it, I didn't really mean to say beautiful, because I'm not really sure how that plays into anything. He stops, clears his throat a second time to regroup. Either I'm wrong about you, or else you have some other reason for being here. Who the hell calls someone beautiful anymore? My thoughts are reeling. This isn't some after-school feel-good movie special. But I resist the urge to pull my blanket over my head and ignore him. My face isn't feeling the cold anymore anyway. Good night, Oxford. The words form clearly in my mind. But then I see Evie's face. The stain of rouge on her lips as she blows me a kiss. The hope in her face when she breathes the word Amsterdam. And when my mouth opens, I say something else entirely. I'm trying to buy back my little sister.
Chapter 6. Jules. The morning dawns cold and thin as Gaia's jewel suns creep over the canyon rim. One half of the sky is still inky black, stars scattered carelessly across it, but the other is slowly shifting from a metallic gray to a soft orange. By noon, it'll be baking hot again,
but just now the air is crisp, and I could live inside my little silver cocoon forever with no complaints. Except, that is, for the temple beside us, beckoning me with a pull so strong I'd almost think it was supernatural, if I hadn't felt it ever since I first learned about the Undying from my father. My earliest memory is of sitting on his lap while he tried to work, and I alternated between trying to take off his glasses and trying to use my best pencils to color in the glyphs he was working on, the paper charts stretched out across his desk. This has been my journey as long as I've been alive. I'm not sure how much I actually slept last night, buzzing with the need to just leap out of my sleeping bag and sprint toward the temple's entrance. Beside me, Mia sits up, tearing her breather mask away and squinting at the canyon rim as though it's to blame for all her woes.
"Stupid goddamn alien sons," she mutters, transferring the blame neatly. "How the hell do I know what time it is when there's two of them?"
I wriggle around until I can free my hands, hitting the display and bringing my wrist unit to life. I pull my own mask away.
"Six,"
I croak, my voice still rusty with sleep and the bone-dry air from the breather. Mia fixes me with a look that adds me to the list of things she's blaming for her current predicament, but keeping her blanket wrapped around her like a cloak, she slowly clambers to her feet, shifting from one foot to the other to get the blood flowing.
"I'll check the canyon, see if there's any sign of other camps. I'll make breakfast."
I force myself to move, wincing as every muscle in my body lines up to file a complaint about yesterday's trials. And I thought I was fit.
"If you see any hostiles incoming, let them know we need about an hour or so before we're ready to flee for our lives."
That earns me a sound that's certainly not a laugh, but might be a distant relative hovering uncertainly at the edge of the family photograph. I set to work with the wave stove, pulling together the quickest breakfast I can manage. I only really won one argument the whole of yesterday, but as the scent of porridge and cinnamon slowly revives me, I'm bloody glad it was the one about keeping my spices. While she's gone, I can't help thinking again about what she said last night. Her sister. She wouldn't say anything more after that, pretending to be asleep, though I know she was faking it by the way her breath kept varying. A sister should be illegal, especially in the U.S., where the population control laws are incredibly strict. I'm not quite as naive as she thinks I am, though. I can guess what happened. We received the first Undying transmission over 50 years ago, but decoding it, building the portal, testing it with probes, unmanned drones, and finally manned missions took decades. It was only about 15 years ago, when Mia and I were toddlers, that the first clear images came back of Gaia. It was then that some people started breaking the one-child laws, thinking we'd settle the planet in a year or two, and there'd be space for everyone to raise more than one kid. Mia and I were still children when geologists and astronomers worked out that one of Gaia's suns gives off a solar flare every few decades, like a cosmological Old Faithful, and dashed any hope that Gaia could be a permanent second home for us. Only the simple, single-celled bacteria in the oceans survive each flare. The discovery of tangible life on another planet knocked the scientific community flat when the first samples came back, but the rest of the world was more focused on the extinct race of sentient beings trying to communicate with us. For most of us, the bacteria are just a reminder that nothing more complex could ever live on Gaia. Without those solar flares, though, we wouldn't have been able to date the Undying ruins. The cut stones of their structures have been absorbing radiation with every solar eruption since they were built, for less time than the surrounding ground and cliffs, which allowed my father and his colleagues to calculate the age of the temples to a staggering 50,000 years. But whether or not Gaia was ever going to be the answer to Earth's overpopulation problems, Mia's parents still broke the law. Her sister's existence is illegal,
which explains why Mia might have to think outside the box when it comes to helping her out of whatever circumstances she's in. It also complicates my role in all of this. Whatever aversion I feel to bringing a scaver inside the temple with me, I can't deny the urgency of her mission. I might not come from the same kind of underworld as Mia. I might never have set foot in it. But I know enough to understand it's not hyperbole when she says, buy back. It's not just about money for her, any more than it is for me. And I'm still lying to her. We're both quiet as we down breakfast and pack up our things. Mia's more or less stopped scowling, tamed by the porridge, though her pink and blue hair's still sticking up every which way, her eyes sleepy. Clearly not a morning person. I reluctantly learned to be, after years of early rising for polo practice at the pool, but now doesn't seem the time to rub that in. I suppose we should get an early start on today's law-breaking, I venture, groping for a logical next step. Despite my eagerness to enter the temple, however, it's proving more difficult than I would have thought to turn my mind to the magnificent stone facade above us. It wants to stay focused on the sleep-rumpled girl beside me instead. After years of being told I'm growing up too fast, that I should relax and act more like the teenager I am, this is not the time for my hormones to kick in and decide to do exactly that. Except, apparently, logic doesn't get a vote. We both stare up at the temple we're about to brave. Columns line the steps, inviting, leading up to a shadowy moor of an entrance. At first glance, a passerby, if there were passersby on Gaia, might think it a relic from our own past, at home next to the stone city of Petra, or ancient Egypt's grand Abu Simbel. But the undying temple seems to grow out of the cliff, as though it were organic, part of Gaia, in a way no human civilization could have attempted. The stones are so precisely cut, it's impossible to see the seams between them, except in a few places where sand and wind have nibbled a corner away over the eons. And though the facade before us is of the same red-brown rock of the canyon below and the cliffs above, a glimmer in the dark doorway reminds me we could find anything once we step inside this temple. Temple isn't really the right word. My father and his colleagues used to wince whenever they heard it, preferring structure or complex, anything that didn't hold a spiritual connotation. Because there's no evidence of religion in the Undying's broadcast or glyphed messages on Gaia. There's no evidence any of the structures were built to honor a deity or house their dead. But standing here, my breath steaming in what's left of the desert night and dawn, edging the cliffs with gold, the word structure leaves me hollow. And I understand why the first astronauts on Gaia's surface, scientists themselves, whispered the word temple. Banks and supermarkets are structures. Structures are built and used and torn down and rebuilt and recycled and end up just so much cardboard and plastic wrap. This place is heavy with importance. It calls, the way a church's bells call a congregation to mass, or the cry of the muezzin summons the faithful to prayer. It waits with gravity and consequence, with the ancient serenity of a massive oak. I don't have to scan the radiation levels in its stones to know how long it's been waiting for us, because it's how long I've been waiting too. Always. The moment takes me so abruptly that my knees want to buckle, leaving me floundering, floating, as unable to move as if I were in zero G. I tear my eyes away to see Mia, her eyes wide and breath quickening as she gazes at the temple. I watch her face, see how the fear in her eyes gains not a scrap of ground against the absolute determination in the set of her mouth. And suddenly my feet are on the ground again.
We have to be careful.
My voice is dry and dusty, like the sand underfoot, as I order my feet to start moving.
Once we're inside, we can't get separated. Can't run ahead. Can't so much as step through a doorway without thinking it through.
I'm rewarded with a roll of her eyes as we make our way toward the steps.
You mean...